Just on the topic of precepts, it's sort of obvious, but I haven't noticed that. The topics we covered on this retreat completely coincide with the precepts we have as order members and mitras. Yeah. So we have a precept on mindfulness in the five precepts, and when we ordained, we take up the 10 precepts, and the three mind precepts are about craving, hatred, and ignorance, or wrong views. So what we're actually studying is the mind precepts from the 10 pillars retreat, if you see what I mean here. So in other words, we have committed ourselves to practice these things. Yeah, they're our commitment. So in a way, this retreat is a follow-on from the 10 pillars. So I'm going to talk about the whole area of wrong view, right view, this whole area of views, of opinions, views, and so on. First, a few things about why it is important. Because it can sound surprising that our opinions or our views on life are actually important. And I give you two examples of the Pali Canon, one you probably know, one you probably don't know, where the Buddha talks about the importance of right view. I start with the one you probably don't know. I discovered it in Guhaloka, when I was reading around the Pali Canon, which I think is something good to do. Yeah, so read around the Pali Canon. Anguttara Nikaya 588, I think it is, yeah. 88. So Book of Fives, which means it's the list of five things, Sutra number 88. And it's a sutra, I was very surprised reading it. I found it quite interesting, but it shows the importance of right view and the danger of wrong view, of false view. And it is a sutra where the Buddha explains how an elder monk, so an experienced monk, is acting for the harm of many people. How an experienced practitioner can harm many people. And he has five qualities. The first one is he is long-standing, so dained a long time. The second one is he is well-known and famous. The third one is he gains alms food easily, so people give to him. The fourth one is he learned much. And the fifth one is he holds wrong views. This is the older monk who harms many people. Because he's famous, he's experienced, but he's got wrong views. So he's got all these followers and he just leads them astray. Yeah? So this is the one thing which damages all the rest. Yeah? So I find it quite interesting about the importance of right view and the real dangers of wrong view. Yeah? There's nothing more dangerous than an experienced Buddhist with wrong view. On a more positive side, the other text is probably many of you know it. I don't know which text it is. I did it from memory. But I know the sutta. I don't know where in the Pali Canon. It's Majjhima Nikaya. I don't know which sutta. It's the Kosambi Sutta, the quarrel at Kosambi. Yeah, so many of you probably know the story. Monks were quarreling over something silly, actually. And then, I'm not going to go through the story. But at the end of the text, the Buddha gives six conditions for the long life and the prospering of the Sangha. And the first three ones are deeds of loving kindness with body, speech, and mind towards each other. They're the first three ones, which are quite obvious as sort of ways of cultivating the Sangha. The fourth one is sharing one's possessions. The fifth one is a common code of ethics. And the sixth one is common right view. And then the Buddha said, for the harmony of the Sangha, the common right view is the most important one. Even more important than deeds of loving kindness. Yeah. I find it quite interesting. It's almost counterintuitive. Yeah. We probably think it doesn't matter what our opinions about life is as long as we're nice to each other. That's not how you create Sangha. Yeah. Sangha is based on right view. In other words, Sangha is based on a common right view. That seems to be the basis, one of the basis for Sangha, for religious community. So, yeah, it's two examples where the Buddha talks about the importance of right view and the dangers of wrong view. So, at this point, I want to get clear about the mechanism of wrong view. So what we're dealing with is wrong view and not ignorance. So mitcha ditya, not avidya. So the tenth precept of the ten precepts, you avoid wrong view, you don't avoid ignorance, because there's not much you can do about that. Yeah. So what we're actually confessing when we confess, or what we are working on as an ethical issue, is the cultivation of wrong views and the developing of right views. So it's mitcha ditya, not avidya. Otherwise, you have to keep running around confessing all the time that you're not enlightened. And this is meaningless. And you can't walk around confessing your unenlightenment all the time. So the mechanism, in a way, is the way it works is the root of unenlightenment, or what unenlightenment is, what we are, is ignorance, avidya. Yeah? And as Suhata said, I think it was Suhata in his talk, it's so deep we don't even notice it. It's what we are swimming in. It's actually what we are. Yeah? It's the world. It's everything. Yeah? We don't even notice our avidya. And the basis of avidya is, yeah, it's sort of this, anyway, you could say, not believing in impermanence and change. Which, in a theory, on an extremely superficial, we do agree to impermanence, especially don't think we are. Don't think we really believe in non-self. Yeah? And say, don't, we don't. Yeah? We're inborn selfish. So this ignorance then expresses itself in craving and hatred. The two basic emotional drives. The deeper, I mean, even calling them emotions would be too superficial. Yeah. It's also basic energy, you could call it. Yeah. Which is sort of grasping everything which enhances and feeds me, and avoiding everything which threatens and challenges me. And these are the basic emotions, the basic drives. Yeah. Yeah, so maybe we couldn't call them emotions, because that term sounds something like something you can avoid doing. You can't avoid doing it. And don't pretend you're not doing it. So this is the basis, yeah? Ignorance, craving, aversion. Basic drive to want something and to push away. And then we need to come up with reasons for that. And these are the wrong views. Yeah. So the wrong views come out, they're expressions of craving and hatred. You could say they are the justifications, basically. So most of our views are basically a very creative way of justifying our selfishness. And the level of creativity possible is unbelievable. I mean, it's incredible. Yeah. I mean, when it comes to being selfish, I mean, the level of skill, creativity, and expertise, it's amazing. Yeah. So, in terms of an ethical issue, ignorance is not an ethical issue. Views are an ethical issue. Opinions, views are an ethical issue. I think it's just useful to take those to be clear about this. So what are wrong views? In the 10 pillars, I think I mainly seem to refer to the 10 pillars in this talk. In the 10 pillars, Vanti mentioned some basic and fundamental wrong views. And the ones he, in a sense, I think they are the false views which make a religious Buddhist life impossible. And these wrong views are the belief that actions don't have consequences. You deny the law of karma. The belief that there are no higher spiritual values and no morally based social order. Yeah. So you could say it's what I would call it, not accepting the karma niyama as part of reality. Yeah. That the law of karma is part of the way the universe functions. Yeah. In a sense, it's the belief that ethics is a purely social phenomenon. Yeah? which is not Buddhist. The Buddhist view is it is part of the nature of the universe. So the belief there's no higher, no spiritual values, no values, and no morally based social order. Then the third one, next one, there are no living beings higher than man. Yeah? So if you don't believe in devas, spirit, and ghosts, then you've got a problem. It's materialism. Yeah, it is the view of materialism. Yeah, and we are, I'm sure the study groups will run wild about that. And the last one of these fundamental wrong views, there's no possibility of anyone realizing the highest truth. Which you could sort of translate into sort of current Triratna language, denying the Dharma Niyama. Denying that there's sort of spiritual truth in the universe. So they are very crude false views, and they make a Buddhist, a religious, a spiritual life impossible. A Buddhist life, they make Buddhism impossible, basically. Yeah. And the opposite are the basic right views. It's sort of, Subhuti expresses it in one of the papers, where he said, well, what we need to accept, or if you want to practice Buddhism, is a basic conviction about the karma niyama and a sort of faith in the dharma niyama. Yeah, those are the basic right views of Buddhism, if you want to practice Buddhism. But right view is not only, there's not only general right view, there's a shared right view. So you have asked, or you have requested to join a particular Buddhist religious order. Yeah, you're not just a Buddhist. There's actually no such thing than a Buddhist. In the abstract, in the general. There's only specific Buddhist traditions. You can't be a general Buddhist. Yeah, you can only be a particular Buddhist of a particular tradition. Unless you open your own tradition, which you're happy. You can do if you wish so. So there's something like shared right view or shared views. Yeah, so you could say particular views, which you could say, not define our order, but which are definitely very much part of order. It's to do with views and a kind of language which we use. It's also to do with having a shared Buddhist language which we all understand. One of the things which can be, is confusing is, don't know if you ever do this, if you're in contact with non-Triratna Buddhists. And what I find when that happens, I have to do translation work all the time. Because we're using the same words, but we use them in very different ways. Yeah? You think you talk about the same thing, but it gets utterly confused because you use them in different ways. So part of the shared right view, having a shared dharmic language, yeah, which we all understand. Yeah? And a certain views, certain Buddhist views, might work in particular traditions, but they would make it, they don't quite fit into Triratna. Like taking on a sort of traditional Tibetan Triyana view. Hinayana is lower, Mahayana is better, Vajrayana is the real thing. Yeah. And you want to be the best one, so you practice Vajrayana. This is not how Bhante sees it. Yeah. This sort of stacking up of traditions. Yeah. It's more the different formulations of the same teachings. Yeah. Or the other view, is of the reverse Theravada, the fundamentalist view, only the Pali Canon is true, everything later is wrong. Yeah. Then you have trouble in our order as well. By the way, you shouldn't eat after 12 o'clock then anyway. It's a test. I mean, yeah, it's a test. If you want to be a fundamentalist, do it properly. Yeah, no food after 12 then. I will tell the chef if you're interested. If you want to be fundamentalist, do the real thing. And, yeah. go for it. Yeah, so I think these are sort of views which make life in the order difficult, basically. And, yeah. Or the idea you can have a Buddhist life without altruism. Yeah, that's impossible. Yeah. So there are some sort of specific views, and I think also a particular language we use. So there are certain teachings which I think we should just know if we want to sort of talk to each other. And then, so I think, for example, the teaching of the levels of going for refuge, the teachings of dimensions of going for refuge. I hope you know it. If you don't know what they are, ask your study leader tomorrow. The stages of the path, the five stages. Yeah? They're sort of part of our language. So part of a shared right view is a shared language. Yeah. And in a sense, this creates Sangha. If you don't have that, Sangha becomes very complicated because you have to do translation work all the time. So I want to now look at a few examples of a few areas of wrong or right view. Mainly, I start with the wrong view once and then talk about how to practice right view. So a few examples how we can easily breach the 10th precept. Probably the most common one is exceptions of the law of karma. I think I mentioned that before, that we apply the law of karma as long as it's not too inconvenient. And then it doesn't really count. Yeah? So when you say yourself, you know it shouldn't be doing this, but it doesn't really matter. That's actually, you're cultivating wrong view. And the problem is the justification, not the unskillful action. So justification is almost the bigger problem. Yeah. I mean, that fits in for me with the having a shared ethics, a shared code of ethics. And you take your ordination, you're ordained by a preceptor. So somebody who, you could say, gives you the precepts, or another way of putting it, he witnesses your understanding of the precepts. So for me, ordination is very much to do with the fact that if I ordain somebody, I witness that their understanding of the precepts is very similar to mine. And when somebody I'm preceptor to acts unethically, I mean, I don't mind, it's not so right here, but if he then argues about it, I think, hang on, this is not my understanding of the precepts. You know, it's almost a sort of arguing and sort of justification, which I find more jarring than just somebody acting unethically, because we always act unethically. Mm. Yeah. So, yeah, the justification. There's another version of that, which I sometimes do, maybe you all know it. Again, it's sort of wrong view. It's a version of not believing in the law of karma. It's what I call justification after the event. I mean, that shows that our views come of after the cravings. Yeah, I do something because I want to, and then later I find good reasons for it. Even to myself, actually. I don't even have to justify it for other people. Yeah. Sometimes I do something because I want to, and then I feel uncomfortable with it, and then I come up with good reasons, which I tell myself, fully knowing that I'm lying, but I tell it to myself anyway, to make me feel better. I mean, I hope I'm not the only one that weird, because you're all slightly perverse in a way. Yeah? So it's what I call justification. Just watch out. When you do something which you're slightly embarrassed about, which you didn't really want to do, and then later, or even afterwards, after you made the decision, you come up with very good reasons for it. Yeah. So I think it's another version of wrong view, of cultivating wrong view, so what I call sort of justification after the event. Yeah? Which in a small way shows how our views come out of our feelings, our desires. We can do this also with our practice of Buddhism. Yeah, and again, views come out of desire. I mean, it's so important to be really clear about that. So another way of practicing wrong view is developing or creating a version of Buddhism which suits us. As we do it with the Dharma itself. So, left to our own device, we would probably invent a type of Buddhism which is very convenient and which perfectly fits our personality. So if you're introvert and unsociable, it's all about solitary meditation and insight, and certainly not about having anything to do with other people. If you're very emotional, and you think, and by the way, in this case, rituals are something for the stupid people in the East, not for us sophisticated Westerners. So arrogance comes in there as well. We're very emotional and we don't really want to think. It's all about devotion. And study is just something for intellectuals who are alienated. It's just you invent your own brand of Buddhism, basically. So we just invent our own, since we are in danger of inventing our own personal traditions all the time. And they are very narrow. Or if you're highly extrovert, you think Buddhism is all about Sangha and meeting people and helping them all the time. You never spend time on your own. You never reflect. You never go deeper into things. So I think a narrow view of Buddhism is also a way of cultivating wrong view, because you have a particular view of the Dharma, which incidentally is very convenient. Another area, I think it's quite common, is the influence of, I think it's actually a bit tedious to blame society all the time. It's actually non-Buddhist. It's actually, I wonder if it's actually a good thing for a Buddhist to do that all the time. But anyway, it's the view of nihilism and materialism, which is the view I think most of us grew up with. We don't even notice it. It is, in a sense, comes down to the view mind is less real than the body. Mental events are a byproduct of chemistry and physics. And Buddhism is a way to be yourself a good person, and if you be nice, it's good enough. But in a sense, if you have that view, you deny again karma, niyama, and dharma, niyama as realities. You notice that when you're surprised that Buddhism is a religion. I mean, people can practice for years and they're really surprised when they hear Buddhism is a religion. And then you can be very clever by saying, oh, it depends how you define religion. Richard Gombrich, who is not a Buddhist, but I think he's one of the best friends Buddhism has, says he sort of defines all the defining what religion is tedious and unnecessary, because for all intents and purposes, it is a religion. He doesn't go into all this, we need to define this first sort of thing. And I think usually it's just a way when we say, oh, we need to define what religion is, what we actually mean is, it's not a religion. I mean, that's really what's going on, I suspect. I mean, there's a higher reality, you pray to it, you're in contact with it, there's rituals, I mean, what is it? It's not a philosophy. It's certainly not a philosophy. And it's not science. So if it's anything, it's not a philosophy, it's not a science, it's not a psychology, what's left? I think it's quite interesting. You have this default position. I don't know if it still happens in classes. If the topic of religion comes up, the default is, but Buddhism is different. If the topic of science comes up, the default is, Buddhism, science proves Buddhism. I mean, why should we bother what science proves? A different area of life. But I think that shows the prevalent materialistic view in the attitude. We don't even think about it. It's sort of so ingrained in us. It may also be connected, I mean, I'm guessing here a bit, but it may be an indicator for that nihilistic view is a certain one-sided fascination with emptiness and shunyata. That things really don't exist. Which is a bit on the nihilistic end of the spectrum. Yeah? So an overly fascination with any teaching which denies existence, which is not the Buddhist, which is not what the Buddha taught, by the way, because it's one-sided, could be an indicator for nihilistic views. Yeah? Any overly fascination with any teaching which denies existence. Yeah, so fascination with shunyata and so on. So it's a huge area, sort of how much we are materialists and nihilists. Another area of views where we have to be careful is something, I bring it up here, I could bring it up later again, is sort of convenient ignoring certain teachings, like that craving is a problem. It's sort of, I mean, we're really fascinated by the Lakshanas, aren't we? I mean, sort of, it's great, yeah? But the fact that the root of suffering is craving, this is a problem. Do something about it. Yeah, it's almost an embarrassment. I mean, and I wonder how often it's really talked about in classes, in centers. Yeah? It's not. I'm not sure how popular a topic it is. Yeah, I think we sort of shy away from that area a bit. It's a bit of an inconvenient teaching of the Buddha. Unfortunately, it's the central teaching of the Buddha. I mean, but it's something it's a bit embarrassing, isn't it? Sort of, we don't really talk about that. Yeah, so we ignore teachings. It's a bit inconvenient, especially the teaching of craving is a problem. Yeah. But at least these are views. Another big area, and Subhuti talks about in his writes about it, is the whole area of doubt and vagueness.
Sorry?
Doubt, vagueness, unclarity. The wish to be, the desire to be unclear. Which comes down to the unwillingness to make up one's mind. I think it's a big problem, actually. Yeah. And it's a very, I wonder if sort of hopeless is the right term. It's a serious thing. I'll say later why. Now, we all know the theory that honest questioning is a good thing. We know the theory. Yes, it's a good thing. And honest questioning is different from neurotic doubt. But I think in practice, it's not that clear. Yeah? I think honest questioning is the wish to engage. Because honest doubt, honest questioning gets you deeper into things, into practice. I mean, that's maybe a way of, So if you have honest question about a practice, you do more of it. I think that's the point. An honest questioning makes you do more of a practice because you want to grapple with it. I had this many years ago with the six element practice, which I found difficult to relate to. So I thought, maybe it's not for me. I thought, no, it's not. Why should we not practice for me? Other people can do it. Yeah. So I just did more of it until I cracked it, which is great. So I think that's sort of more a real questioning, a real honest engagement. Yeah. Neurotic doubt is you avoid it, you run away. And it's an excuse for not practicing. And often when we're in neurotic doubt, we tell ourselves it's honest questioning, but I wonder. That's why I think, yes, they are different, but is it really that obvious what we're doing? So doubt is a way of not engaging. It's a way of finding excuses to not engage. And it can look very intelligent. It can look really clever. Yeah? If you've read too many books, some of us are too clever for our own good. Yeah? You can be really clever and argue your way out of practice all the time. Yeah. This vagueness, doubt can manifest in different ways. Yeah, if you're very clever, you come up with all sorts of questions. And stuff, yeah? Or it can manifest in being fascinated by, what do I call them? You sort of create this cloud of unclarity around you, which is filled by a pseudo-profound banalities. Yeah. In the end, we don't really know. This is sort of saying. Yeah, it doesn't mean anything. It just means I don't know. Yeah. It's not. It's actually not profound to say that. It's just expression of ignorance. Yeah. This will create this cloud of unclarity around you. That's what it feels like, something. This is sort of mist or sort of cloud.
Could you repeat that initial sentence? A cloud of...
ignorant of pseudo-profound banalities. They look profound, but doesn't actually mean anything. And often, this, in the end, we don't really know, comes at the end of discussions, not at the beginning. So when you're cornered, and you can't, and you know you're wrong, then you do the big sort of nuclear option of, well, we don't know anything, don't we? Yeah. And I think, well, what didn't you say in the first place? It could have saved a lot of time. So if you believe that, say it at the beginning, it can save a lot of time for everybody. It can also disguise as openness and tolerance. Yeah? Because we are scared of appearing, and note I say appearing, narrow and dogmatic. It's not about being narrow and dogmatic, I think it's appearing narrow and dogmatic. Yeah? Well, the thing is, religions are different. Different religions have different ideas about reality. Yeah, sorry. They're not all the same. If you think all religions are the same, that must be based on years of study of all religions. Have you done that? Yeah? Have you studied all the kinds of Christianity? All the different kinds of Islam, Hinduism, Machinism, Shinto? Well, you don't actually know what we mean when we say that, don't we? Or, even worse, we tell other people what their religion is. You know better what Islam is than all those Muslims who practice it. That's what we are saying if we say all religions are the same. Yeah? It's quite a claim to make, isn't it? So it's sort of, it looks tolerant, but it isn't. And by the way, when I lived in Germany, I was very active. Well, sort of, not very active, it's too much. I was active in interfaith work, and the area of we all agree and are the same is over. It's not said anymore in interreligious meetings.
The what?
The era of saying we're all the same is over. We don't say that anymore in interreligious meetings because it doesn't actually, it's not true and it doesn't help. Yeah. So it's a bit behind. Now, as I said, it's also quite interesting that just watch yourself, and it's quite an interesting phenomenon. I think this fear of being clear and standing for something, yeah, that's basically what we are afraid of if you sort of think we have to be tolerant and open. It may be to do with the fact that maybe Buddhism isn't important to us enough. If something is really important to us, then we actually stand for something. It's an interesting phenomenon, for example, that, I mean, it happens every now and then in discussion groups. The same person who is very afraid of being clear about Buddhism, that this is true, can be very dogmatic about other areas of life, like politics. Yeah? It's very interesting. So the same person who sort of, we should be tolerant and maybe other people are right, others are right, has the same view that people of a different political view are either evil or misguided and stupid. And it's not, and that view isn't even questioned. Which, by the way, sounds very much like the mindset of the Spanish Inquisition. Yeah. So in some ways, in some areas, the same person can be highly dogmatic, whereas being very sort of open and tolerant in other areas. Yeah, so it's quite interesting, other areas where you're highly dogmatic and so, yeah. But in the end, doubt is about, as I said, sort of the unwillingness to make up one's mind, because then you have to act, you have to commit. Maybe say more about doubt. So what to do about doubt? I thought, what can you actually do about it? And it's very difficult. I wonder whether sometimes it's said doubt is the worst hindrance. Because the problem with doubt is you're questioning the very means to work on it. So if you are craving or hatred, the normal hindrances we all have, yeah, at least you have, yeah, you've got a problem, but you still have something to do. Yeah, you're still engaging with the Dharma. If you doubt the Dharma, then the Dharma can't help you to get out of doubt. Does that make sense? You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. So I thought, well, what can you actually do about doubt? I'm not sure. I don't really know, because that is the problem. Yeah. I mean, why should you ask a Buddhist whether you should be a Buddhist? So the only way I could think of to deal with it is, in a sense, ask yourself what you really want. I think it's the only way I can, sort of, what you actually really want to do. Yeah. I must say, I find it quite sad. I mean, when young people don't know what to do with their lives, I think it's more or less normal. Yeah. I think from a certain age, I find it quite sad, actually, sort of old people who seem to drift around life and, I mean, you're going to die at some point. I mean, do something with your life. I mean, no matter what, yeah. There's something quite, I mean, I find it quite sad. The sight of sort of old, and by older I mean from 40 on this too. There's something quite sad about older people who don't know what they do with themselves and sort of drift around life aimlessly and sort of, yeah. So maybe that's the way to deal with it. Ask yourself, do you want to end up like that? Yeah. And an ethical question, think about the effect you have. Yeah. I mean, I know it sometimes happens in going for refuge groups that there's a member who doesn't know whether he wants to be ordained. Now, we can't go through all those phases, that's fair enough. Yeah. But if it goes on for too long, it has an effect on the group. Yeah. So it's sort of, the ethical dimension on that. Yeah. I mean, in the end, you may decide to leave the movement. I mean, it's always an option. Yeah. Yeah, so doubt is funny because I don't know what to do about it, really, because yeah, it's self-defeating. Okay, so in a few ideas I had sort of how to practice right view. So what do you actually do? First of all, I want to quote, relate to the 10 pillars again, the 10 pillars of Buddhism. Abhante talks about the 10th precept, and he says to practice right view, we need to do three things. One, be aware to what extent our thinking is influenced by false views by which we have been surrounded. Second, realize that they reinforce unskillful states. And the third one, an interesting one, discuss anything to do with the Dharma or the order in Dharmic terms. Yeah, so any discussion about the order and the Dharma would be in Buddhist terms.
Could you repeat the second one, please?
Realize that they reinforce unskillful states. Because it's easy to discuss the order in non-Buddhist terms. I mean, like, you use terms like somebody is conservative. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, actually, in the Sangha. Yeah, it doesn't, these terms don't seem to make sense. Yeah. Positive things one can do, read the Dharma or listen to talks. You don't have to re-listen to talks. It's quite straightforward in a way. Yeah? To quote Suwata, become a Sangharakshita expert. Or in other words, speak our language. Learn our terms. Yeah, one which I mentioned earlier on. Then, of course, there's study with others, study groups. Study is a practice. Yeah. It's not that there's study and then there's practice, which is also a convenient excuse for not studying, yeah? I'm not into study, I'm a practitioner. In other words, I'm better than those silly people who think they have to read the books and understand what Bhante says. to discuss with others. And one of the effects of study, I find, is to do with it exposes views. So what study actually does, it exposes wrong views, or exposes our views. They get sort of made conscious. What does this mean? Also, when you study anything, especially if it looks obvious, look repeatedly at the same topics or the same texts. Yeah, repeat the study. It's always safe to assume that there's more to understand in a text. I mean, two examples I could think of, which I think I personally don't really understood yet fully, or what it's going to do, is Sangha. I really think, personally, I think for many of us, there's a lot in it which we haven't quite, there's more to learn what it actually means. Yeah, there's more to understand what Sangha actually means. I feel like sort of, yeah, I've got a certain understanding of it, probably good enough in a way, but I'm quite aware there's something else in there which I haven't quite got yet. Yeah. And the other area, something sort of had to get more interested in lately, it's a current one, the whole teaching of the system of practice or system of Dharma life. Yeah. Because it actually evolved. It didn't sort of spring into existence finished. Yeah. And I'm sure our understanding of them can evolve further. Yeah, I'm quite sure there's more to get out of it. Actually, I must admit, I've got a bit of a love-hate relationship with the system of practice. I find it highly interesting and useful. But whenever I feel it gets solidified, then I get bored with it. But actually, as something to work with, it's brilliant. I mean, it's really good. I think it's a stroke of genius, I think. Or language of a system of practice. I think it's actually genius, yeah. But every now and then, I feel, maybe it's just my reactivity, it gets sort of into simplified down to something, yeah. Like they put in the mandala way, and then this is how it is now, this is in the center. And it takes the life out of it for me. Yeah. So keep the teachings alive. Yeah. But I was thinking, we're not at the bottom of this yet. Maybe we never will. So repeat the study going deeper. And then there's a practice which I can highly recommend, is reflecting. Just sit and do nothing and reflect on a Dharmic topic. Maybe a few tips how to do that. In a sense, be disciplined about it. Do it every day for 20 minutes or something, half an hour. So it helps. The topic you reflect on, make sure it's actually Buddhist. There's this brilliant webpage, Fake Buddha Quotes, which can highly recommend for entertainment. There's all these famous Buddha quotes which don't exist around. It's amazing what the Buddha is supposed to have said, which he never, they don't, it's just made up basically. Yeah? So if you reflect on a Buddhist topic, make sure it's on a sentence or a saying, make sure it's Buddhist. Go for simple teachings. And nothing. Make sure the thing you reflect on isn't complicated. So you don't need to understand it. Reflecting means you don't need to understand it intellectually anymore. It's finished. You've done that. Yeah, you know what the words mean, and that. So that I'll get a few examples later on. Yeah, so don't reflect on things which require too much complicated thinking. I don't find that this gets complicated. And there's another thing about reflecting. Oh, let's give a few topics first. So possible topics, the brilliant one, impermanence. I think I can highly recommend it because you can't think about it. Because there's nothing, yes, it happens. Yeah, you can't build a theory out of it. You can just observe it. Yeah. So your sort of overly active thinking mind gets frustrated with it. You can just observe it. So the lecture, especially impermanence, dukkha, non-self, I tend not to reflect on non-self because I find it too complicated. I'm not particularly fascinated by it personally either. So I prefer the other ones, dukkha and impermanence. To make impermanence more concrete, death. You can reflect on the fact that you're going to die. Yeah? Or you get ill. Or you get old. Yeah? Old age, sickness, death will come. Yeah? So just sit with that. Or you can reflect on the law of karma. How's my ethics? Or you can reflect on the Buddha. I think it doesn't have to be a Dharmic topic. Reflecting can also be the Buddha. You just think about the Buddha. So the whole point of reflecting is keep it simple and uncomplicated. Avoid anything complicated. And there's something else about reflecting which I sort of discovered, and I was surprised how strong the effect was. You don't have to come up with a result at the end of the reflection. That's why I find reflection exercises very difficult, because if you talk about it afterwards, if it's a single... I find that's why I can't do reflecting exercises in groups and situations. I just can't do them. Yeah. In a way, if you just stayed with the topics for half an hour, that's good enough. And if you've got nothing to say afterwards, no new insights, nothing exciting, that's good enough. It's actually good if nothing new happens, in a way, yeah, because you just stayed with the topic. I found that really important when I did it for a while, that I found really helpful reflecting without having to come up with some interesting, profound result at the end. It's very liberating. And connected with that, don't study, or do study and reflect without teaching it. So it's usually said, and it is true, that you really learn something if you have to teach it. I mean, that's a common, we all know this, yeah? So if you teach Buddhism or the Dharma or meditation, that's a good thing because it means we have to really understand Buddhism and meditation. That's all true. But what I found was, when I study something in order to teach it, it's almost the fact that I have to then explain to somebody gets in the way. Does that make sense? Yeah, sort of, I almost think more about the audience and how I might formulate it than about the topic. Yeah, it's almost study the Dharma for its own sake. Yeah. And I think it also is a danger if you're too quick with explaining and teaching, it stays superficial. Yeah, it's almost sort of the teaching goes through you without being digested. It's a bit like sort of teaching something you just heard is a bit like having diarrhea. So food it just goes through you without being digested properly. It's not part of you. Don't want to push the analogy too far. So it stays superficial. Yeah. And what I actually find with, and maybe it's, again, it may be temperamental, that actually teachings or practices which are new to me and which I try out, I don't want to talk about them. It feels, only to a few friends. Yeah? Because it almost, especially if it's something new I just discovered for myself and I try out, I'm actually reluctant to talk about it. Because it's too precious and it's not digested yet. So it needs to be part of me first before I talk about it. So I think there's a lot to be said for studying the Dharma without teaching it. Yeah. I think also if we do communicate the Dharma, I think Ratnaguna said that once, it's important that we have an area of study which we don't teach, independent from our so-called, teaching is a horrible word really, independent from our communicating the Dharma. If the only Dharma we study is the one we pass on, I think it's something missing. And our teaching suffers from that actually. Another way to practice this, as comes to me now, it's more an attitude. I mean, talking about teaching and all this, it's safest to assume not that you're a teacher, but a learner. Yeah. Suwata said in his talks that when somebody wants to get ordained in order to teach, then sort of alarm goes off. And then he said, it would be better if they say they want to get ordained to be Kalyana Mitra. Now, however, now as you heard that, don't try this on us. Don't just come, I want to be a Kalyana Mitra. But I think there's something else. I think it's sort of more, you want to join the order in order to learn. It's far safer. Because your training begins at ordination. That's where the training begins, really. Yeah. You see, I think the term for practitioner is savaka, is actually list hearer or learner in Pali. Savaka. So I think it's even a term which is used for stream entrance. So there's the real disciples, the real learners. So the learning never stops. I think it's the safest attitude is you keep learning. You keep open, be open to learn. A final thing about the reflecting. I don't know if this is completely true, but I mention it because, but I think it is. My suspicion is, and my impression is, any Buddhist topic we reflect on, and I think no matter what it is, ideally, sooner or later, ends up with the question, what am I doing with my life? Yeah, I think every teaching, maybe actually every teaching, maybe just make that claim now, yeah, maybe it's unfounded, but maybe assume that every teaching, even if it looks very obscure at the moment, yeah, if it looks very obscure and strange, sort of, even if it looks very theoretical at the moment, if you really go into it honestly and you really meet it with your, I mean, study is basically, or reflecting is you meet the topic. It's you and this coming together, yeah? I think sooner or later, it will end up with the question, what am I doing with my life? I mean, when I did formal reflection, I used the Dasadama Sutta, 10 things to reflect on, 10 different topics. And after a while of doing this, I realized they're all different ways of asking the same question, which is, what am I doing with myself? Yeah? One topic is death, one topic is illness, one topic is karma, one topic is my ethics. It's my ethics up to, you know, what would my friends say about my ethical life? What are my values? Do I still have worldly values? And so on. Yeah. So my impression is that, talking about right view, at some point, all reflection, all study will end up with the question, what am I doing with myself? Yeah, what am I doing with my life? Okay, so that's what I have to say on wrong view and right view.